Actually, folks, we're going to do the Mideast Madness program right now. This is your friendly neighborhood, local neighborhood, Palestinian-American Wren Lawrence Tawil, presenting Mideast Migraines on... The name of the program is Mideast Migraines. I think I might have slipped again and said Mideast Madness at the beginning. Here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. lovely oud music. Oud is, in English, is spelled O-U-D. It is the historical predecessor to the European lute. So it looks like a big fat mandolin with a short fretboard and a lot of keys. The kind of keys that hold the strings down in place. This is from the album Wooden Heart, produced and featuring Mavroti T. Quintanis on the oud. Yes, Quintanis is a Greek name, and indeed this is the oud played in the Greek style by Greek-American Mavroti Quintanis. Again, the album is Wooden Heart in English, and so we have the oud as a historical stringed instrument, which has found its place in the folk culture of several countries, not only Arabic countries, but Greece and other lands as well, I'm sure, not to mention the United States. And that, by the way, was track 3, Nikris Longa, by M.T. Quintanis, and that was preceded by Mahur Sharkey. Bazmi Sizade Abdiefendi. That sounds like a Turkish name. I'm not sure which is the, Mahur Sharkey would be the name of the piece of music you heard, written by or performed, apparently written by the Turkish guy, Abdi Efendi. Okay, again, this is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'll give the phone numbers out right away. The two phone lines are open. Area code for both of them is 831, the area code for Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California, U.S. of A. 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Again, 427-3772. Line number 2, just in case, just for a little backup here, line 2 is 469-3119. That's 469-3119. If everything goes our way, this program will be... we'll have a lot of electronic interviews in it. But first, let's talk about... let's see. Oh my, some old stuff here. Disinformation Weekly for April 10. You heard me right. Disinformation Weekly, April 10. You know, I admit I took an interest in this e-zine, e-newsletter here because I thought I'd learn a whole bunch of things about issues directly and certainly pertaining to the art and science of disinformation. But there's actually a lot of kooky stuff in this, and I tend to think that that's the real emphasis. I mean, not in the sense of the Onion Online comic newsletter or something intended to be entirely tongue-in-cheek, but it's got a bunch of weird stuff in it. Take this, for example. if I can ever get it to pop up. Here we go. Did Leonard Nimoy fake his own death so he could seize control of the Illuminati? Submitted by Majestic on April 2nd. Here's a bit of fun from... oh, they actually admit it in the very first half a dozen words. Here's a bit of fun from HardDon.com about Star Trek star Leonard Mr. Spock Nimoy and the Illuminati. Don't take it too seriously, y'all. So talk about padding the story from the very beginning. Here it is. In the heady days immediately following the Gulf of Tonkin incident, Leonard Nimoy made a profound decision. It was 1964 and America was being torn apart. Ethnic minorities were rioting. The hippie movement had grown into a domestic terrorism threat, And the newly installed President Johnson was on the verge of committing troops to an all-out war in Southeast Asia. I guess the reference to the hippie movement as a domestic terrorism threat is along the lines of the birth and development of the Weather Underground. That would be my interpretation. Anyway, continuing, in the midst of all that turmoil, Nimoy made the crucial decision to enlist. This picture of, a black and white picture of him standing in front of a shuttlecraft. You know, one of the original sleek, clean versions from the old original series. No, the 33-year-old actor, this is 1964, the 33-year-old actor had not joined our military forces fighting against communism in Vietnam. Instead, he enlisted in a far older, far more momentous battle, one being waged for the very future of the human race. He had decided to join the cast of the new science fiction television series Star Trek, and in doing so, finally accepted his destiny as a foot soldier for the Illuminati agenda. What? It was the culmination of decades of training and the beginning of a 50-year rise up the dark pyramid of global power. Manchurian candidate with Romanov roots. Details of Leonard Nimoy's early childhood are necessarily vague. The media has fed us a predictable timeline of predictable life events, though his genealogy is, at best, obscure. However, it is clear that Nimoy's March 26th birth date does anticipate his future role in New World Order propaganda, for it was on that day in 1484 that William Caxton printed the first translation of Aesop's Fables, and also in 1830 when the Book of Mormon was published in Palmyra, New York. Incidentally, Star Trek has long been accused of being a palimpsest of these two works. Whatever palimpsest that means. Continuing. However, the most fascinating counterpoint to Nimoy's manufactured backstory is the theory that he may have been the secret love child of playboy Maurice de Rothschild and Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna of Russia. Smuggled to America at an early age, he was entrusted to a nondescript family in suburban Boston, then a safe haven of New Deal liberalism. Back then, suburb outside Boston was a safe haven of New Deal liberalism despite the ravages of the Great Depression. His lineage was crucial, as we shall see, for it bound the child to the two great dynasties of hidden rule, the Romanovs and the Rothschilds. It was also a dangerous bloodline to possess, as the treachery of both families knows no bounds. As a Rothschild, young Leonard was naturally raised as a Jew. And even as a teenager, he betrayed all the trigonomic and sensual qualities of that exotic race. Folks, remember what it said at the very beginning up here. I have not read this article before. This is my first exposure to it. But as she said, as they say, here's a bit of fun from HardDon.com and about Leonard, Mr. Spock, Nimoy, and the Illuminati. Don't take it too seriously, y'all. That's my preface and proviso there. Keep that in mind as I'm reading this. I mean, I know I'm your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American, but don't start descending on me for any of this. Bad enough I mentioned the word Rothschild. Anyway, where was I? That exotic race. At the height of the Cold War, Nimoy joined the United States Army's Special Services Division. Ostensibly, he was stationed at Fort McPherson in Georgia, although there have been reports that he was assigned to the secret base at Dawsonville, where a nuclear power plant, some of the most cutting-edge CIA-NSA experiments of all time. Bad sentence. It shall come as no surprise to learn that Nimoy's military records were completely lost in a, quote, suspicious fire in 1973, as even CENTCOM has been forced to admit. Oh, There's a link here. I'm not going to go into it, though. This is all in fun, remember? An Illuminati star is born. Nimoy spent the ensuing years in Hollywood exploring a carefully curated series of acting roles meant to educate him in the themes of futurism and power. When Gene Roddenberry, a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemason with his own ties to military intelligence, became Nimoy's handler in the 1960s, the actor fully embraced his fated position in the New World Order disinformation machine. Star Trek is what analysts would describe as predictive programming, i.e., which is to say, a subtle way of seeding the media with clues about future events. Predictive programming. It makes the public far more apathetic towards dangerous change. In the case of Trek, the show introduced the concept of a United Nations-style government having complete control over a multicultural society that lacked private property, elections, or even genetically proper family units. Genetically proper family units. Instead, we are shown a soulless empire where interspecies sexual relations are the norm and faith is derided as archaic. This is, in essence, just how the Bible describes the beginning of the end times. Once you start identifying all the subliminal messages, Trek begins to look heavy-handed in its Illuminatic/satanic agenda. They're introducing the story to us, and I'm hung up on this one picture of someone who interview with Colin Christian, tripophobia. Oh, I wish you could see this. It could be a fake. Anyway, let's see if we can continue with this with this article. Yes. Okay. Once you start identifying all the subliminal message, Trek begins to look heavy-handed in its Illuminati/satanic agenda. The captain of the ship has the name Kirk, which coincidentally enough means church in Scottish, as if the Freemason Church of atheistic militarism is meant to replace the role of Jesus in our lives. Kirk took over from Admiral Pike, while the real Albert Pike was actually the creator of modern New World Order theology, Albert Pike. The rest of the crew represents a polyglot of multicultural interbreeding from Sulu, the homosexual Asian. Well, George Takei, being homosexual anyway, was not represented on the series, I'm sure, as a homosexual. To Dr. McCoy, a potent early symbol of Obamacare and RFID chips. On their uniforms, these soldiers wear a not-so-subtle pentagram. Yeah, I guess it would be. Additionally, the show introduced notions of ESP, atheism, the ascension of Apple's iPhone products, disguised as communicators, the hidden reptilian, and even the NSA's concept of information dominance control. And this is meant to be the future utopia we all dream of. There's a picture here of that one episode of Captain Kirk on a desolate planet fighting the Gorn. A caption says, Kirk's famous fight against Gorn may symbolize humanity's battle against the reptilian Illuminati elite. Of course, it goes without saying. When casual Satanism is not enough, Leonard Nimoy's Spock character was the most nefarious of all these Illuminati archetypes. Spock is a Vulcan, a species where logic and reason reign over passion and faith. He is devoid of love and cannot comprehend the majesty of Jesus Christ. Yet his pointy ears reveal his true Mephistophelian nature, and make viewers understand there is a deeper secret message here. In fact, the word Vulcan means an ancient god of fire in Roman mythology. Interestingly enough, this god Vulcan, much like Nimoy, was disowned by his real parents and cast out into the world. I seem to recall that he's more of a slightly non-benign mutual parting between him and his mom and dad, mainly between him and his dad. At any rate, Vulcan was disowned by his real parents and cast out into the world. Some historians even believe that Vulcan is an early incarnation of Satan himself. Or believe that Vulcan is an early incarnation of Satan himself. Exclamation point. Finally, many have noted that Leonard Nimoy's famous V-shaped hand gesture is little more than an inverted pyramid, Illuminati pyramid. You know, live long and prosper thing with the hands there, the V-shape. A gesture, perhaps, that he was challenging the hierarchy of that most ancient institution. He claimed that he came upon the signal spontaneously, yet further investigation reveals it has deep ties to the satanic underpinnings of the letter Shin from Hebrew Kabbalah, and was also favored by Druid Illuminati Satanist Winston Churchill. I will tell you, I did see the interview where Nimoy explained where his explanation for where he picked up that hand gesture was, while he was in temple, there is a certain part in the worship service where the worshipers in the congregation there turn away from the rabbi or the other officials directing the service, not as a display of, you know, turning their backs on them, but turning away so they could not see the certain details of a ritual involved with what I believe is a standard Jewish Sabbath worship service. The rabbi would hold their hand up, separating their middle and ring fingers, Vulcan greeting style or salutation style, because it did indeed, this hand gesture did represent the letter Shin from the Hebrew alphabet, although this article specifies the Hebrew Kabbalah. And a little boy, Leonard Nimoy, broke with tradition, shall we say, and dared to look over his shoulder while the parents and other people were turning away, and he saw that this is what the rabbi was doing, holding the hand in the shin shape, shall we say. So that's where he got that from, according to Mr. Nimoy himself. Let's continue with this article. Spock's message of Kabbalistic Illuminati Satanism became Leonard Nimoy's métier in the next five decades. He extended his creative influence beyond television to films, photography, education, music, and even real estate. Curiously enough, Nimoy's accumulation of power neatly coincides with the rise of Hollywood as a global force of mind control. Along the way, newer celebrities have fallen within Spock's Illuminati orbit, such as Jay-Z and Beyoncé, who both employ the infamous V-shaped gesture in their public pronouncements. And a picture of Spock giving the shin sign, as it were, with the caption, "What better way to teach naive teens to invoke the devil?" Ooh. Let's continue here. The death hoax unmasked. With the stunning power of Hollywood and the NSA critical information infrastructure behind him, Leonard Nimoy was likely no longer content to play foot soldier in the Illuminati army. When one studies his astrological divinations, it seems... predicted that he would rise to challenge the old guard, the European leadership of bankers and kings. One could point to the death of Lou Reed or the sudden success of chemtrails as indicators that the Illuminati was suffering internal conflict as America became a new center of geopolitical strength. Yet, how could such a high-profile figure like Leonard Nimoy seize control of the Illuminati without the paparazzi catching wind of it all? Faking his own death seems almost predictable when one considers the options. It elevates the man to a mythical status. It's not like he wasn't mythical to begin with, I think. While subverting, I mean, a status being of mythical proportions, while subverting the genuine threat he poses to the future of our freedom. It would also be illogical not to assume that elites like Nimoy have access to medical treatments far beyond the comprehension of everyday citizens. Wouldn't an Illuminati insider take advantage of these resources if he was even ill in the first place? In fact, wouldn't it be safer to assume that Nimoy's ties to the dark underworld of Satanism are far more likely to provide him with a lifespan beyond a normal human? It should come as no surprise that this is the very notion predicted and programmed into the Star Trek movie franchise. And yet, even if that theory might be a false flag, a cover-up of Leonard Nimoy's true reptilian nature, which would afford him a longer life, a far longer lifespan, as so blatantly foretold in his famous catchphrase, "Live long and prosper." Pope and Queen. There's a picture here of the Pope, of Nimoy himself, bounded on either side by the current Pope Francis and the Queen of England, Elizabeth II, with the caption, "Nimoy may have wrested control of the Illuminati from old Europe, and the Pope and the Queen are not happy." Pope and Queen outmaneuvered. Just this year, two earth-shattering developments in the Illuminati pyramid of power level, that change is happening. Pope, whose authority was seemingly absolute, has announced he may be leaving his throne soon. Additionally, the MSM has been releasing its predictive programming of the upcoming demise of Queen Elizabeth II. Both events would have been unthinkable a decade ago, and certainly would not have happened without the permission of the Pinder, the pinnacle of the Draco. If anything, the aggression of these two, The aggregation of these two world events and prophesied signs prove that the houses of Rothschild and Romanov may have finally been outmaneuvered by their very own prodigal son. In conclusion, it must be asked, does Leonard Nimoy's rise up the Illuminati pyramid of power represent a change in global power dynamics? Are we as a civilization moving away from finance as the primary means of population control and towards the very futurism that the character Spock embodies? The sudden ubiquity of the internet and revelations about NSA, National Security Agency, National Security Administration, spying seem to say that Nimoy's early gamble on technological humanism has paid off. As the Federal Reserve and Rothschild banking empire fades, does a far more sinister New World Order future await us as Nimoy consolidates power and shifts civilization's, quote, evolution into higher gear? These are the crucial questions that anti-Illuminati activists must ask themselves as the futurism of Leonard Nimoy's Star Trek satanic simulacrum leaps from science fiction to fatal reality. Speaking of, I was given a start by the notion that the Pope may be leaving his throne soon, but that is a picture of Francis, I'm pretty sure. This is dated March 31st this year, 10 days ago, 13 days ago. Again, at harddawn.com, because morning in America won't be easy. This might be a worthwhile website to continue to refer to. But not if all the articles are like this, I can't really make heads or tails of this. I don't know how much of it is true. Not that I'm guessing that the Illuminati factor is true. But like we were warned, plenty of time. we're supposed to take this stuff lightly. That picture is just creeping me out. Okay, this is the Mideast Migraine Show. Honest, it really is. On Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's 3:34 in the afternoon this Monday, April 13, in the year 2015. So, what else is new here? Okay, let's, we were directed to that story by disinformation.com. Here's an interview with Sam Bahur. The thing is, I want to get you the basic information about Sam Bahur. Who is a Palestinian. And boy, did I ever misplace that item. Tell you what, let's listen to this. This Vimeo interview led by Katie Miranda. We've heard a number of interviews by American Jewess Katie Miranda at katiemiranda.com. And this is her interview with Sam Bahur. Featuring this title here, Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. Let's go with Sam Bahur here. Let's start it again so I can give you the translate these for you. Palestine Solidarity Telesummit, produced by Katie Miranda Studios. www.katiemiranda.com. Did I mention she sells jewelry to Sam Bahur, Americans for a Vibrant...
Hi, and welcome to the Palestine
Economy.
I'm Katie Miranda, and today I'm here with Sam Bahur, a business development consultant living in Ramallah. Sam frequently provides independent commentary on Palestine and serves as a policy director for Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. So, Sam, your family background and history as a Palestinian is complicated. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? You were born in the U.S., but you live in the West Bank. Can you tell us how you ended up in the West Bank working on the development of the Palestinian economy?
Sure. First, I'd like to thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I guess from a personal perspective, my personal family history is not any more or less complicated than most Palestinians in the world. My father left Palestine back in the 50s, before the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And when the occupation took place, he was outside of the country, thus he was not able to return home. So he's not a refugee. He's from the West Bank, but he ended up not being able to return back to his birthplace, and thus remained in America, became a U.S. citizen, and until today, actually, he's not allowed to come back to Palestine until he's only able to come back to Palestine as a tourist. I was actually born in the United States. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio. I was very active politically around the Palestinian issue. And when the opportunity arose, which was actually after the Oslo Peace Accords were signed, I used that opportunity to relocate. I was married for 1 year to a Palestinian woman, and my wife came back home. I relocated from the States, from Youngstown to Ramallah, specifically to Albide, where I live. And the reason I came back was to actually participate in the establishment of the Palestine Telecommunications Company. It was one of the sectors, telecom was one of the sectors that was partially transferred to the Palestinian side during the Oslo process. So I came with was hired by a group of investors to help them put together the company, which today is the largest private sector employer in Palestine, called the Palestine Telecommunications Company. And I've been here ever since. Did a couple of things since then, but we had one daughter in the States, and we brought her back with us, of course, and we had a second daughter here. My older daughter is currently a junior at MIT studying chemical engineering, and my younger daughter is in the ninth grade here in Ramallah.
Okay, great. So you're one of the founders of the nonprofit Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. Can you tell us about the goals of that organization and where did the idea come from?
Sure. Back in October of 2013, I made a speaking tour in five states in the United States. And one of the legs of that trip was in Chicago, Illinois. And a colleague of mine, a retired American business person, his name is Ed Thompson, set up for me about a dozen or so events to speak at and people to meet. And after that trip, the idea came up that we want to be able to link Palestinian businesses and American businesses for the sake of supporting an independent Palestinian economy. That's very difficult given our economy is an occupied economy. It's militarily occupied by the Israeli military. And a lot of the donors who are working in our community, specifically Western donors or U.S.-oriented donors, always are trying to promote the Palestinian business world, but they're trying to do it with forcing us to work with Israeli business interests, which we see as a very awkward kind of approach. It's not a natural thing to do business with your military occupier because the imbalance of power which is on the ground translates into an imbalance of power within business relationships. So we're hoping to be able to convince the American business community that Palestine is an economy that's worth investing in for many reasons. First and foremost, because we are an economy and we do have things to offer from an investment perspective. For example, our tourism sector is only now just starting to become developed. And the example that I like to give most is, you know, what hotel operator in the States would not like to have a property in Bethlehem? And Bethlehem being smack in the middle of the Palestinian areas, we want to be able to make that kind of a relationship happen. But I have a second reason why I'm focusing on business relations as well. It's because I believe in the U.S., which is a very important factor in this conflict, the business community has shied away from trying to understand reality on the ground. And through business relationships, we're hoping to educate a community of people who work within a business world of how difficult the Israelis have had it for us to be able to do business and how much restrictions the Israelis have placed upon us. We're hoping with the leverage of American businesses getting involved in helping us do business that they would have some clout to be able to try to convince the Israelis or at least reveal to the world what the Israelis are doing in the business community. So that's the first goal, linking businesses across Palestine and Israel, Palestine and America. The second goal of the organization is, to put it bluntly, take ownership of the concept positive investment. If you recall, during the last several years, many church organizations attempted to pass divestment from Israel resolutions. And the pro-Israeli lobby in the States blocked that and made it a major issue. And the way they blocked it is they created this concept of positive investment. I kind of joke when I say that because I've been working in the business community all my life, and I never heard anyone say, hey, I have a great negative investment. Would you like to invest? The word investment is positive by definition. Mm-hmm. So when they added the word positive investment, what they are trying to do is to say that the only things worthy of investment in Palestine are investments that have Israeli involvement. Oh. So we want to be able to reframe that issue for positive investment to mean occupation-free investment as much as possible, understanding our reality. So we're not interested in normalizing a business community with the occupation. We want to remove the forced dependency that our business community has on the occupation, and we're hoping to be able to do that in this venue by involving Americans directly with the Palestinian economy.
That's amazing. That's really fascinating, too, because I really didn't know anything about the Israeli, quote, positive investment. I mean, that's a subject that doesn't really get reported on much, at least not from what I've read.
You know, Katie, there's also a big thing that gets discussed around this issue. People, many in the activist community, feel that it's odd that we would be promoting Palestinian business while we're occupied. And I'd like to clarify how important it is that Palestinians on the ground find livelihood. Because if we understand this conflict as a political conflict, because that's what it is, it comes down to two very simple issues, land and people. And we can see what's happening to the land. I mean, if you drive around the occupied territory, you can see settlements, you can see an Israeli road network, you can see checkpoints. What we can't see easily is what's happening to the people. And what's happening to the people is that our economy is being suffocated by the Israeli military, trying to force people to fall into despair. So for every job we can create in Palestine, we are keeping a Palestinian on the ground engaged. And if he has a job or she has a job, hopefully constructively engaged. So there is a kind of hidden agenda in supporting the Palestinian business community. And it is fully in line with resisting this occupation. But we do it through the business lens.
Yeah, and I want to mention, again, I mentioned in one of my earlier interviews, the documentary Donor Opium. It's about how investments from overseas and charity money from overseas is actually hurting the Palestinian business sector. And so if people haven't seen that documentary yet, I really recommend it. It's 20 minutes long and you can find it on YouTube. You've seen it, right? I'm sure.
Yeah, I have seen it. I actually am a founder of a community foundation here called Dalia Association. And one of our goals is to be able to shed our dependency on donors, because the donor involvement has skewed our economy and has ripped apart the fabric of our society. And we need concentrated effort to be able to re-thread our society together. And one way in doing that is creating business relationships and opening markets for Palestinians to do business without the need for us to go through our occupier to be able to do that.
Fantastic. Those are excellent goals, and I totally support them. So what are your immediate fundraising goals for Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy? Again, this is a nonprofit organization that you founded.
Yes, it's nonprofit. It's also just recently received its 501c3 tax-deductible status in the States. We launched on 1/1/2015. We spent 2014 planning for the organization. When we launched, we actually hired a Palestinian consulting firm to go out in the market and actually vet and find for us opportunities, business opportunities that we can present to U.S. business interests. That consulting firm has started working, and we are attempting to fund their existence with us for at least a year to give them enough time to actually produce 30 investable kinds of projects. And we're doing this in a very transparent way. As we identify potential investments or business relationships, not necessarily financial investment, but maybe distribution agreements or others, we will be placing this information on our website, which is a4vpe.org, the number 4. Anyone interested to find out what kinds of opportunities that we feel are worthy of linking to a U.S. market will be able to see those and either contact them directly or we'll be more than glad to facilitate contacting them. We are not being part of a transactional issue here. We are linking and matchmaking. We're not in the business of doing business. We're in the business of linking businesses together.
Okay, great. So If your average middle-class person wants to invest in the Palestinian economy or partner with Americans for a vibrant Palestinian economy, what would that look like? Is that even something that a middle-class person could do, or do you have to be really wealthy?
No, there's a lot that you can do at any level within the economy. And I'll mention a couple of them, but we'll be more than glad to receive inquiries from anyone who would like to discuss specific cases. If one wanted to invest directly into a Palestinian firm, they can look at the firms that we're going to present and contact them. At a smaller investment level, one can actually approach their community organization, whether it's a church or a solidarity movement within a specific community, and make an investment through their entity. Let's call it a church for the sake of our discussion. And that would be able to be an educational opportunity to get people aware and use their interest to be able to leverage that into a larger kind of investment. There's also different churches which have already started investment programs in Palestine that people can link into, whether it's the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran Church, the Quakers, the Methodists. They all have programs here to be able to support Palestinian business. There's also several Palestinian projects which can be funded through the various crowdfunding websites that are out there, like Kivia or Kickstarter. I'm actually a mentor for one of the projects that's being done at Harvard University, which is also a startup. And we can point people in the direction of where these are. And that would be able to take a smaller amount of investment and put it in the pool of funds that others are putting in to be able to support a specific project. I should note that our work as Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy and the projects that we will present will be geographically spread from throughout Palestine, including the Gaza Strip. We believe that Gaza has a huge future for development. It's under distress right now, but the only way we're going to be able to contribute to removing that occupation's chokehold on Gaza is getting more people involved in raising the price of the occupation. So we're hoping that some Palestinian businesses see the potential development, for example, of the shore of Gaza, which is on the Mediterranean Sea, and have interest in wanting to develop that and put some pressure on the Israeli side to allow us and them to be able to access the Gaza Strip. So it'll be from Gaza, it'll be from throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So there are many different kinds of projects at various levels of investment and interest. But I need to reinforce, not everything we need is financial investment. For many of the companies here, opening up doors to a U.S. market is much more valuable than an actual financial investment. So if we have a food supplier here, we have many of them. For example, we have one that's producing a high-quality honey. If someone can open a door for this company to be able to get their product on a chain of supermarkets in the States, that's much more valuable than just trying to invest in the company. So there's all different kinds of ways people can help the Palestinian business community sustain itself. And again, we'll be more than willing to entertain any kinds of inquiries that come through the website.
Yeah, you know, I actually just ordered a bunch of really beautiful decorative tiles from the Palestinian Tile Factory in Hebron to decorate my house. And I'd love to see those sold here in the U.S.
There's so many products here that are very applicable to the States. Easter is coming up. Bethlehem has some of the best souvenirs and woodworks and jewelry, I think something close to your heart as well, that people can link into. And some of this is already online, and they can reach it through the various sites of these companies. So if you want to be able to support Palestine's resistance against the occupation, there's many ways to do it. All we're saying is supporting the business community so people have a livelihood while they're sustaining their life under this very disastrous occupation. That would translate into either buying Palestinian products or helping Palestinian companies reach other markets. And there's many different ways to do it.
So let's talk about Gaza a little bit more. Is it possible right now to hire freelancers in Gaza, say, to do website design or management? And how would people go about doing that? And the reason I ask is because I'm sure you've heard of the websites Odesk.com and Fiverr.com, where people can hire people from all over the world to do small or medium length or even long term freelance jobs. And I was wondering if that's possible for people in Gaza to do that, or how do people reach people in Gaza?
Yes, it is possible. It's not easy these days. Gaza today has 12 to 18 hours without electricity. And that in itself speaks volumes. Having said that, my own personal firm, my consulting firm, Applied Information Management, we have a translation service, and most of my translators are in Gaza. And by the way, most of them happen to be women as well. So we try to bring in translation work, Arabic, English, Hebrew, and Spanish. The Arabic English is done in Gaza, and try to supply them with that pipeline of work. It has taken a lot of effort to be able to get them the generators and the fuel required to be able to operate their laptops, and we're jumping through hoops to make it happen, sometimes at a loss, but not always. So it is possible, not easy, mainly due to the failure of the electricity not being there 24/7 due to the Israeli restrictions placed on the amount of fuel that can come into the Gaza Strip. But we're doing the best with the resources that we have. And like any business under such distress, we do have backup plans and other people outside of the Gaza Strip to pick up where the Gazan community is not able to serve a specific client. So we can provide seamless service as a Palestinian company to an international client. But we'd like to note that we're trying to do as much as possible of that work in the Gaza Strip. And the other place that we try to support is East Jerusalem, which is also under distress these days from the Israeli practices. So where we can do the work in Gaza or East Jerusalem, we will. And if not, we will use resources in the West Bank or elsewhere to be able to get the work done.
So can you tell us a little bit about the situation with PayPal? I know, like, when I last checked, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza were not able to use PayPal because PayPal did not allow connections to Palestinian banks. And I saw this the most vividly, like the most egregious example of this inequality is on the website Etsy.com, which is where I sell my jewelry. And I see, you know, loads and loads of Israeli designers on there, but the only Palestinians are the ones who live in Israel proper or in Jerusalem. And I thought that was just like so unfair that Israelis are able to tap into the international market like that, but Palestinians aren't. So do you know anything about the current situation with PayPal? And is there anything that the international community can do to move that issue forward?
It's a very good question. I don't know the details behind it, but yes, it's not a service that's available to Palestinians, and that's a problem. It's part of the financial infrastructure that would allow us to be able to link to the global market. The issue has to do not only with PayPal, but with a lot of international organizations that only now are coming to the realization that the Palestinian market is a market, is an economy, separate from the Israeli economy. That, to me, is an opportunity for us to be able to educate as many of these companies as possible, and not only in a soft way of educating them, but also in a legal way of educating them. Any international company that continues to view the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem economy as part and parcel of their economic agreements with Israel is legally out of sync. After especially November 2012, when the majority of the world accepted Palestine as an observer state in the UN. And based on that UN resolution, they actually added Palestine to the lists of states in the world. So whether it's PayPal or Amazon or any of these companies, when you do the drop-down box to go to the country, if Palestine is not listed, that company is behind the times. And that, to me, is an opportunity for us to approach the executives of the company and explain to them, first and foremost, the new state of affairs that happened in November, but more so, those companies that would like to contribute to a positive economic development in Palestine need to be able to provide these services and tools for us. In the meantime, some of the Palestinian banks, one in specific, the Bank of Palestine, has created a new product here. It's called PalPay instead of PayPal. And PalPay is basically a network of payment points of sale, which is developing very rapidly, hoping to pick up the gap of where the PalPays of this, the PayPals of this world have failed. So that's we great. Are trying in a very creative way to fill the gap. But as much as we do, it will not be able to be 100% because ultimately these international platforms are global platforms. And we just want to be part of those global platforms so we can do business worldwide and people can do business with us. I should note that there is not an issue with the banking system per se. The banking system here is a very vibrant banking system. It's a regulated banking system. It's part of the international and global banking system. So these companies cannot say that there's anything weak within the Palestinian banking system per se, because the banks work here and they do transfers abroad and everything is in place. It's just an executive decision at these companies to add Palestine into their lists of countries that are able to do business with them. So it's a, to me, it's an activist kind of task waiting to be addressed. And it can be addressed very concretely and very businesslike as well, because this will add to their business revenue. We're not asking anything more than any other country asks for, which is to be part of their global networks.
So can people in the international community use PalPay to hire Palestinians? Only for Palestinians to use amongst themselves?
Right now, it's a domestic network. It was just launched several months ago. I believe their plans are to open it up for people abroad to be able to interface with the network. But I'll need to check exactly where it's at now. But there's many other ways as well. I mean, just straight bank transfers work as well. There's other services that are out there that allow transfer of money, like Western Union and other services that do work here. So it's not a completely closed environment. It's just not totally open. And those are the, like you've properly noted, we need to find where the global platforms are that are closing their doors to Palestine and tell them, open the doors to Palestine. It will help them as a business and it will help us develop. And if we develop, then we're creating a new reality on the ground. If the doors of the world remain closed to Palestine, we can only expect more violence and more occupation here. And that's the kind of equation we want to be able to present to American businesses and others.
So aside from the checkpoints, the wall, and controlling entry into Palestine, can you give us some examples of how Israel further inhibits Palestinian economic development?
Yes, I can probably speak for 3 days on that topic. It's a big issue. In a nutshell, and I'm using my words very carefully, Israel controls, micromanages every single strategic economic asset for state building, whether it's land, water, which is very important in our part of the world, trade relations, movement and access, petroleum, electricity, you name the strategic economic resource, and it's the Israeli military who is in control of it. Some of those resources, some of the crumbs of those resources have been provided to the Palestinians. And we do the best we can with the crumbs that are thrown to us. But ultimately, if we're headed towards independent statehood, those economic resources will have to be released. One of the largest ones is a natural gas reserve off the coast in the Gaza Strip. That gas reserve has enough value to make us totally independent from the need of donors. So you can imagine American tax dollars are propping up the Palestinian Authority. They're paying Palestinian Authority salaries, where if the American government would just use its leverage in getting Israel to allow us to tap our own natural gas, we wouldn't need those tax dollars to be able to sustain our reality here. So those economic resources are important for many, many reasons. First and foremost, to be able to build an economy that's worthy of a state, but also to relieve us from this donor dependency, which is really skewing the entire reality here, and in a way, propagating the occupation. Because today, Israel has an occupation, which is a profitable occupation. They pay very little to be able to sustain an occupation. Actually, just the opposite. This is a profitable occupation. We are the second largest captive market to Israeli firms. So they're making a lot of money off of this occupation sustaining. So again, these economic resources are key to our development, and we're hoping that some even larger U.S. companies will take note that we have some very strategic economic resources, and we want to be able to whet their appetite for them to see that there's a potential business interest here for them. But for them to be able to benefit from it, like us, we need their support to convince the American government and others to be able to get Israel to remove the boot of occupation from our neck.
Okay, so you wrote an article about your proposal of how to move forward should John Kerry fail in his negotiations, and clearly he has. So can you tell us about your proposal and how it's being received?
Yes, very, very briefly. It's actually a joint effort between myself and a British researcher. His name is Tony Klung. And we looked in April of 2014, long before the Palestinian leadership took a move at the UN to try to set a date for ending the occupation. We looked at this issue and we basically came up with the following. We basically said that 50 years of occupation, because that's what we're embarking on in 2017, 50 years of this occupation is way too long. And we basically say that there's two huge ambiguities that the Israeli side is using to sustain this occupation. The first is they don't recognize it as a military occupation. And the entire world, including the U.S., recognizes the state of affairs here as a military occupation, which means the Fourth Geneva Convention applies. And we think, number one, the Israelis should be called on that ambiguity. They need to be asked clearly by the international community, do they recognize this as an occupation or not? If it's recognized as an occupation, then the second ambiguity comes in. Is 50 years not enough to decide that it needs to end? And if it's not an occupation, like the current Israeli government continues to tell us, then we expect third states to start dealing with Israel as a state which is prohibiting subjects under its control from having their rights. And we can keep talking about two states until we're blue in the face. But in the meantime, we should not accept one more day where the entity which is in control from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River is prohibiting half the people living under their control of having water rights, health rights, political rights. And so we're basically saying, let's put the ball squarely in the Israeli lap. Call it an occupation or not. If it's not, then we're looking for citizenship within Israel, or at least equal treatment instead of discrimination. And if it is an occupation, then let's just set a deadline. We think 50 years is plenty, so we know that it's going to end. But we cannot remain in this world of ambiguity where the occupation is spoken about as if it can live forever as we're negotiating. Negotiating an end game may take another 100 years. If anyone thinks the Palestinians are going to remain silent and subdued during these next 100 years, has not read history. And we can see that now. The level of violence is already increasing against the occupation. And what we're saying is, let's not let it roll out of control. Let's at least give the Palestinians a clear deadline of when this will end. And that's an issue that the international community has to step up to the plate for, because we as Palestinians are not able to do it ourselves.
So at this point in time, what, in your opinion, do you think is the most important way people in the international community can support Palestinians?
Many ways. First and foremost is to organize in a much more sustainable kind of way. And I'm going to be very frank here, because I think, especially in the activist community and in the solidarity community, because wherever you step foot in the world, you will find pockets of solidarity with Palestinians. And when Israel attacks Gaza, within hours, there are demonstrations across the world calling for it to stop. And those are always needed. But I think what's missing in the equation is more long-term organizing and long-term planning. I'm working within the business realm, as I noted before, but there's many different areas that we can work on a more long-term basis. And I think one component of how to think forward of supporting Palestine is to come down to a sectorial level. Not everybody should be expected to help everything, but rather we should look at the health world and see how can healthcare workers around the world support the Palestinian healthcare system. The same for education, the same for culture, the same for arts, the same for business. And as we bring these communities, which are already having a common language together, then I think we have the ingredients to have a sustained relationship to be able to improve reality on the ground, both in resisting the occupation, as well as much as possible, building for a free Palestine. And that's not an easy task. But it can't be done only through spontaneous kinds of demonstration activities. It has to be done in a more structured and long-term kind of fashion.
Okay, great. So Sam has given everybody, all the listeners out there, a lot of brand new ideas about how to support the Palestinian struggle. So I want to thank you very much, Sam, for taking your time to be with us today. And I want to support the work you're doing with Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. So this month, the month of March 2015, I'm going to give $7 of every purchase of jewelry and apparel to Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. So if you are considering buying something, now is a great time. You can help support the Palestinian economy by doing so and get their project moving forward. So thank you again very much, Sam, for being with us.
Thank you.
And indeed, that was an interview by Katie Miranda of the Palestine Telesummit, Palestine Solidarity Telesummit. And as I've indicated on many programs, Katie has hosted a number of interviews in the last few months with many personalities involved in the conflict and the debacle, as it were, between Israel and Palestine. She was actually doing one interview per day for a period of 2 or 3 weeks, and those have kind of died off. There are only so many people that you can easily arrange daily interviews with. This, I believe, is her most recent. From about a month ago, I received a notice, about 5 weeks ago, actually, March 2nd. The way Katie explains it is right here. She says, I'm taking a different approach with the video interview this month. Instead of focusing on political activism, I want to branch out and find out more about economic activism, something that tends to get sidelined in the Palestine solidarity community. So, as you heard, she interviewed Sam Bahur, a business development consultant living in Ramallah, the current de facto capital of Palestine, still in occupied territory, development consultant in Ramallah. Sam frequently provides independent commentary on Palestine and serves as a policy advisor of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. He, Sam Bahur, blogs at ePalestine.com, ePalestine.com, ePalestine, of course, one word. Sam, through his work at the newly formed nonprofit Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy, is educating the American business world about how difficult the Israeli occupation makes doing business for Palestinians. His goal is for American business people to start putting pressure on the Israeli government to allow Palestinians the freedom to develop their economy. It was particularly encouraging to me to hear about the many fronts upon which Palestinian entrepreneurs, to a remarkable degree independent of the Palestinian Authority government there, sub-Israeli government as it were, how much and how successfully independent Palestinian entrepreneurs are in developing the structure of an economy. It's not just olives, olive oil, and what's that stuff? Za'atar that's being produced and exported with great difficulty. It is even to get this stuff outside of the territories and to a world other than to the nation of Israel. He talked to a very encouraging degree about how Palestine is looking forward to a more open market to places other than to Israel, and how Palestine can develop its economy totally. And I mean, he meant totally independently, independent of Israeli economic hegemony. And the Palestinian economy not controlled directly or indirectly by the whims of the Israeli government. Or as it says here, obviously this is the part that I wanted to read before you heard the video, but at least you heard it, and now I can digress by reading this. Sam is drawing needed attention to the flip side of divestment, that is, positive investment in the Palestinian economy. This means investment free of Israeli occupation control, more or less, as I was saying, that removes the forced dependency on Israel. Remarkably, this is we're beginning to look at a more hidden form of control by Israel and what is, as he points out here, a forced dependency on the Israeli economy and the whims of the people, the government, and the economy in Israel, and that this really is another form of suppression, was what it is, repression and suppression of the Palestinians' ability to generate their own income, create a thriving Palestinian market, and in that way, well, among other things, prove to the world that Palestine is already, to a very unlimited degree, unfortunately, so far, an independent market. And I believe as long as Israel can keep the wraps on that activity, they can continue to subdue the notion of a national Palestine, of an independent secular and democratic Palestine, and take everyone's attention off of that. In the interview, you heard Sam explain how people just like you can invest in the Palestinian economy, which in turn creates jobs for Palestinians, which allows them to stay in Palestine. That is another important linchpin, another reason why Israel would suppress this information, is they're looking forward to a day when all the Palestinians would leave Palestine and leave Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, to the Jews and to the Jews only. That is not an anti-Semitic statement at all. That is the track record of Israel, and that's how Israel has been operating for two-thirds of a century. Okay. And I'll just read this last paragraph here in the explanatory page. February's fundraising campaign for If Americans Knew was a success. Together we raised $497, which will go to putting up a new billboard. What else can you do with under $500? For the month of March, I, Katie Miranda, will be donating $7 from every item purchased at www.katiemiranda.com. She sells jewelry, folks. Donating $7 from every item purchased there to Sam's nonprofit organization, Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. In solidarity, Katie Miranda. She's up in Portland, Oregon, folks. And her website is, I think it's Katie at katiemiranda.com. Just plain Katie Miranda. K-A-T-I-E, Miranda, M-I-R-A-N-D-A. KatieMiranda.com. Okay, time for a break here. Little relief from the monotony. Listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let me give you our postal address here so you can send us all your money. Yes, folks, how can you possibly have a strictly grassroots community, quite literally underground pirate radio service without donations from the community which we serve, and frankly, with which our radio service should have a lot more interplay, interactive relationship here. Now, I've not gotten a single phone call. All the buttons seem to be on. Let's give you the phone numbers once again. Well, and I promised you an address so you can be given the opportunity to avail us with your generous donations and keep this service going. In terms of money, and quite frankly, in terms of minor considerations like crew morale, we're not exactly at our highest point. Free Radio Santa Cruz has now been in operation for a good 20 years and 1 month. We had our technical birthday last month because it was in March of 1995 that we began liberating the airwaves of Santa Cruz with our unlicensed, non-compliant with the Federal Communications Commission radio operations here to allow us to operate freely from the reins of corporate control and corporatism in the American media. That's the idea. We do have music and stuff, including the kind that the feds would rather not have anyone hear during all hours of the day, 7 days a week. But there's plenty of talk, to be sure, and lots of reruns and refeeds of many classic and other not-so-classic programs. Yeah, we really do need your help, folks. First of all, I'd like to invite everyone to go to www.freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Click on their semicircle of various links there. You can click on info or about us, whatever it says about the service, and also the contact link, where you will see before your eyes the postal address that I'm about to give to you here for your donations. You may also download a copy of the application that we have for new programmers from that link on our website there. If you think you might be interested in being a radio disc type jockeying person yourself. Okay, here it is. Please send your donations, check or money order, please only. Send your donations to Free Radio by writing on the envelope Free Radio Santa Cruz, or simply write FRSC. Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, that's two words, S-A-N-T-A, Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, California, optical character reader abbreviation is simply C-A, zip code 95061. Let me give you the address again so I don't confuse people with my clarifications of everything. Mail your check or money order donation as little or as often as little or as much as you can, as often as you can, please mail the donation to FRSC, stands for Free Radio Santa Cruz, 781, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California 95061, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. I always want to say the 7811 first because something else was scratched out, and it's, the way it's written here, it's easier for me to skip the P.O. box and just go right to the number. It's FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Incidentally, my programs are recorded when I can get the darn recorder to work here, and archived at two other websites. This is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, ALL.net, radioforall.net, and look up Mideast Migraines there and get the most recent and many much older recordings of my programs there, including the book readings that I do on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. Currently, in the second half of Anna Balzer's book, Witness in Palestine, An American Jewish Woman in the Occupied Territories. Anna Balzer, remarkable series of journal entries in her several visits to Palestine starting in 2003. That, quite frankly, is very difficult and painful for me to have to read. And relating to it as a Palestinian-American as I do, and probably quite difficult for many people to have to hear what's going on there in the territories. So that's the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, 11 a.m. Pacific time, Pacific Daylight Time. Always 11, whether it's daylight or standard, here in the left coast of North America. Pacific time, 11 a.m. at 101.3 FM. And our free streaming service online at freakradio.org.
That's one. Previous episodes of that and other books that I've read on the Saturday edition are available at Radio for All.
There is another website you can go to retrieve most easily my most recent programs. That's Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Santa Cruz, like the city I already gave you the spelling for. Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y. Santa Cruz Media Center, Indie Bay, to be more complete. And it's easiest just to go to radioforall.net. That's the quickest and easiest way to get the recordings of my previous programs. Now, if you want to send a message to me, do it through this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Michael, X as in Xavier.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Okay, it is 4:30 in the afternoon, this Monday edition of the program for April 13th, 2015. We're just recording away here. You know, in the specific folder that I have for programs set to put out to you in the course of my program, there's a bunch of stuff that, understandably, I never got to, including items that I've never even opened. So I'm going to share the wealth of stuff here. This is about 2 years old, February 27 of 2013. You may think 2 years old is just too damn old. How could that pertain to me or any of this stuff? When I read this, listen and you tell me whether or not it pertains. In fact, you might want to pay close attention to how little things have changed in 2 years, or for that matter, 10 years, 20 years, depending on what you're talking about. Passed along to us from Hassan Fauda, Hassan, from the Palestine News Service, PSN, entitled, Disgusted Israeli Jew. Disgusted Israeli Jew. Read this letter from an Israeli woman of conscience. Then reflect on what you can do to end the complicity of our government, the United States government, in aiding and abetting Israeli crimes. The U.S. either pay for the crimes with our tax money, look the other way, or shelter Israel from facing the consequences of its crimes and violations of international law and Universal Declaration of Rights. I believe the UDHR is a document coming out of the United Nations. That note, personal note to us from Hassan Fauda. Again, 28 February of 2013. Dear friends, after having read the news today, I feel dirty.
Not as if I'd been rolled in mud. No, as if I'd been rolled in shit. Excuse the expression, she says here. I don't know if it's age or something else, but I can't take what I read. Imagine being a Palestinian and having to live with it, and having to live it. The day started well. We, spouse and I, drove to the OPT, which means the occupied Palestinian territories occupied by the State of Israel. We, my spouse and I, drove to the OPT to visit close Palestinian friends and stayed for lunch. We played with the kids, talked a bit about what is happening and what the chances are for an outbreak of violence. As for the latter, no one really seems to know, according to our friend. And when we came home and I went to the computer to read the newspapers, one item was worse than the other. Jewish, apparently religious, women attack a Palestinian woman passing by. Palestinian children are shot by Israeli occupation forces, IOF soldiers, and lesser things such as entry being denied, and somewhere along the line, Bibi, referring to Prime Minister Netanyahu, again harps on Iran. Of course. He has to turn at least Israeli eyes, if not the world's, away from his policies and acts in the OPTs. Throw sand in our eyes, as if we don't see through his miserable doings. Again, this is written by an Israeli Jew. She identifies herself, by the way, as Dorothy here. Now let's continue. Of course, harping on Iran, of course, he has to turn at least... Okay, I read that part. All in all, I'm ashamed to say that I can't take it. I read the first item about the attack on the Palestinian and see in my mind Jews who in the 1930s in Germany and Austria were also attacked for just being Jews. Let me step to the door here and let the next programmer in.
Thanks. I hope it didn't break your tone or anything.
Okay, I'm back again, folks. Sorry about that. That was a little unexpected. And again, where was I? I guess come. I'll start the paragraph again. All in all, I'm ashamed to say that I can't take it. I read the first item about the attack on the Palestinian and see in my mind Jews who in the 1930s in Germany and Austria were also attacked for just being Jews. What has Israel come to? Or has it always been like this? The Nakba was not easier than what today's generation of Palestinians suffer. Nakba, of course, referring to the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their homes, their ancestral homes, villages, and cities in 1948. Continuing, will the children whom we saw today and whom I love so dearly have a chance to grow up to be productive and happy human beings, or will their dear lives also be cut short by a Jewish bullet? I apologize, but I had to let off steam. You were not obligated to read my ranting, but I must admit, if yesterday was bad, today is worse. And I haven't heard a word yet today about the four Palestinian long-term hunger strikers, but presume that they are still alive. The international press, by the way, had no interest in Israel today. But there is enough in the Israeli press and emails to read. Below are nine items. Here are her nine items that Dorothy lists here. Item number one is about the attack on the Palestinian woman. Items from the press, no doubt, here. Interestingly, it is in the Hebrew print edition of Haaretz, but not in the English online edition. The three links take you to various reports about this nasty incident. In item two, Amira Haas tells the Israeli occupation forces, the IOF, that the classification of the bullets used is not the issue. The issue is the kids they wound and kill. Item 3 reports on an Israeli refusal to allow a Palestinian, to allow a teacher of Palestinian origin, but who was born in the USA and grew up there, to re-enter the West Bank, notwithstanding the fact that she has a visa good for a year. In item 4, Amira Hass tackles the question of why the Third Intifada hasn't broken out yet. Item 5 informs us that Israel's prime minister turns attention to Iran, telling us all that only military sanctions, whatever they are, will bring Iran to its knees. I wonder what will bring Bibi to his knees. Remember, folks, this is from over 2 years ago, this article here. Item 6 reports that the United Nations demands to know more about why Israel sent over 1,000 Sudanese back to Sudan. Item 7 informs us that an EU, European Union report, blasts Jerusalem's settlement policy. In item 8, EU diplomats tell their governments to do something to stop Israel. Yes, and about time. Yes. Israel thumbs its nose at the United Nations, the EU, and whoever else is critical of its policies and acts. And why should Israel behave otherwise? It has felt the bite of sanctions, of boycotts, of major divestments. When the EU gets serious and puts teeth in its demands of Israel, maybe then, just maybe, Israel might feel forced to change its ways. And yeah, I guess that was item number 9. Left out that significant digit. That's it for tonight, friends. Maybe tomorrow a better day. All the best, Dorothy. And it's 4:49 p.m. And I believe I indicated in the first hour of the program I was hoping to bring you a second interview. There is simply a second recorded interview. Simply not enough time today. So I'm going to just continue to wade through some of the older items that I've wanted for a long time now to read to you. In the case of that last one, over 2 years. Well, let's see what this one is about, who wrote it, and when it was. This is dated January of this year, the penultimate day of January 2015. It's from J Street, the political home for pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans. Admittedly, I and a number of my associates have a difficult time with J Street, because we simply don't see how they can ultimately successfully break out of the dichotomy of being self-admitted Zionists, but also in favor of Palestinian rights on a parity with Israeli rights. But that's us for you, and that's J Street for you here. Again, this is from a good friend, Daryl. From a couple of months, 3 months ago here. Hi, you may have seen this mailing from J Street on university campuses, as in J Street U. While supporters of justice for Palestinians may find their view and effort fairly superficial, which is to say support for a two-state solution, they are an agitating thorn in the side of the American-Israeli establishment lobby by calling for an end to both the occupation and settlements. This is progress, folks. Slow, yes, but that's how most entrenched systems change, short of violent revolution. Supporters of Palestinian justice might find some useful allies here in the quest for change. J Street U will likely be prodding its parent J Street more toward the left as well. It's also possible that Open Hillel, a much more radical campus group, will push J Street U towards a more radical stance. These are hopeful signs. That note from the guy who sent this to me, Daryl. Here's the article. With no peace process on the immediate horizon, it's easy for Jewish leaders to throw up their hands, say, "There's no partner," and continue on with business as usual. But the occupation persists. Israel continues building settlements, and dangerous legislation threatens Israel's democratic nature, even as the broad security challenges continue to grow. The American Jewish community, especially in the absence of a peace process, must take bold leadership for Israel's future. So, earlier this year, when J Street U held our annual Winter Leadership Institute, we focused on what we can do to help demand that kind of leadership. From over 60 campuses around the country, J Street U student leaders gathered in Los Angeles to discuss the state of our movement, sharpen our organizing and advocacy skills, and strategize next steps for how we're going to support a two-state solution and an end to the occupation. In L.A., we sat down with Chemi Salev, the U.S. editor at Haaretz, to tell him about our work. We discussed everything from settlements to our concerns about the growing strength of the BDS movement to our experiences growing up in communities that felt uncomfortable with our views. Our message was clear. The American Jewish community has not done enough to help bring about peace, security, and justice for Israelis and Palestinians, and that needs to change. This weekend was intense. But our mission is clear. Our institutions must communicate to their Israeli counterparts, the U.S. government, and their own constituents that the status quo is totally unsustainable and that we reject settlements and occupation. What does that mean for us? We're going to hold American Jewish institutions accountable. The majority of American Jews share our pro-peace politics, and it's time for our organizations to reflect it. We've already begun to do some of this work. A few months ago, J Street U echoed a call by Israeli Young Labor for Jewish institutions to speak out against de facto bus segregation in the West Bank. While some leaders, like Rabbi Rick Jacobs, spoke up, most of the community remained silent. That silence in the face of the occupation and its injustices is something we have to change. From maps that erase the green line to funds that grow the settlement enterprise, some Jewish institutions are doing more than just staying quiet. That's why our first question for communal leaders is, where are our resources going? We know how challenging this will be. As a pro-Israel, pro-peace student, I often feel ignored and marginalized by the larger Jewish community. When I attended the Jewish Federations of North America General Assembly in Georgia, apparently, GA, along with 25 other J Street U students several months ago, panels of Jewish professionals lectured us on how to think and act regarding Israel, while some dismissed our views as naive and parochial. What bothers me about how so much of the Jewish community has responded to our activism isn't that we weren't being listened to. It's that by dismissing us, they're shooting themselves and Israel in the foot. Let me read that again so we all understand. What bothers me about how so much of the Jewish community has responded to our activism is not that we're not being listened to. It is that by dismissing us, they're shooting themselves and Israel in the foot. Listening to us isn't just about making sure that young, energized Jews stay involved and active in Jewish communities. It's also about acting on concerns we have about settlement construction and Israel's future. Concerns shared by many Israelis. If we fail to act on them, I worry about what Israel looks like for future generations. J Street U's thousands of student leaders will give our institutions a clear choice to make. They will support a peaceful, secure future for Israel or more settlements and occupation. Will they support a peaceful, secure future for Israel, or will they support more settlements and occupation? One of the best ways to get their attention is by demonstrating the vibrancy and importance of our constituency. You can do that right now by registering for J Street's 2015 National Conference and Advocacy Day. I have no idea when that will be or was. Remember, this article is from 2 or 3 months ago. Finishes off by saying our activists are committed to advancing peace and making sure the Jewish community is too. Will you join us? Benji Cannon, president of J Street U. Copyright 2015 J Street. I fail to appreciate the difference between the overall umbrella of J Street and J Street U. Somehow I don't feel I'm missing too much. Well, folks, it's 4:48. Just in case anyone would really like to talk to me, in the 7 minutes remaining, let's give out the phone number again here. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, 831, Santa Cruz County, California, 427-3772. That's line number one. Line two, 469-3119. Area code 831-469-3119. Come on, you brave souls. Give us a sign that you're out there listening. I know you're out there listening, a few gazillion of you, on this wonderful, totally independent, premier pirate underground radio service, Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're out there. I can feel it in my bones. I know there are some of you listening to our stream. There's no way for me to know how many people happen to be listening to us on the old-fashioned radio set with the tuner and volume knobs. Yeah. Let's see if I can slip one more quick one here. Actually, considering... Oh, hey, someone, is this a coincidence? Are they calling about what I'm talking about here? Hello, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, well, I want to thank you for your show. You know, you remain interesting. When you're talking by yourself, it does sound a little idiotic sometimes. It'd be nice if you could have some conversations with some people, because I think you're very interesting. Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I guess you've hung up. I of course, I always appreciate supportive statements like that. If you're still listening there, caller, and not to mention everyone else, I did have a live interview. I believe it was 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was a week ago Saturday, with a gentleman I became acquainted with on the net. His name is Bruce Gould, who doesn't want his location given out on the air. He didn't want his location admitted during our interview. He is an American Jew who, as he put it, around the turn of the millennium here, some 15 years ago, began to pay attention to the details on current maps of the West Bank, what's supposed to be Free Palestine, and the Bantustanization of that area, thanks to the Israeli wall, which is really an apartheid wall. That's what it's called by many because it is recognized as being in such a separation wall, which does not merely separate the Green Line Israel from the occupied territories. It was imposed into occupation territory at the whim of the Israeli authorities with absolutely no consultation or permission of any Palestinians, regardless of rank or status in their society or government. Sometimes by a few miles or several kilometers, the wall was installed westward, generally, into the occupied territory so that Israel could include its illegal under international law settlements. Creating the Bantustan nature of the West Bank and making it far worse for the Palestinians. This wall, which supposedly is simply to keep suicide bombers out of Israel, which could be accomplished if Israel would truly engage in genuine peace talks and decades ago could have established an independent Palestinian state. Instead, they decide to treat the Palestinians like caged animals. And as for the Israelis' part, once you have the wall up, all indications are that without this continuous threat under those circumstances, under those conditions of Palestinian suicide bombers and attackers, etc., none of the Israeli Jews think about the Palestinians on the other end of the wall. They become totally oblivious, as though they weren't to begin with, of conditions for the Palestinians, have no idea of the misery that wall is creating for them. Okay, well, thanks for the call. I know it was crushed in there at the last moment. I appreciate it. And don't forget to contact me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Join me next Monday for the next Monday episode of Mideast Migraines. Also, don't forget the Saturday edition at 11 a.m. when I'll continue the reading of Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Thank you. Goodbye and ta-ta.